Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we wrap up the week. On the program today, we'll be talking about books. This is something we do every once in a while, and I always enjoy it. I think listeners do too. The idea is that we have guests who round up new books, things that they have been reading that they think might interest you. It's a way of introducing you to some titles and some writers that you might not know about. And we tell people who are listening that you can do the same. If there's something that you've been reading lately that you think is really good and you'd like to tell us and other people about it, you can call us. With us this morning as guest, Philip Graham. He is professor of English at University of Illinois. He teaches writing. He's a writer himself, has published one novel and is it more than one collection of stories?
Two story collections, a collection of prose poems, a novel, and a memoir of Africa.
All right. And you have a new novel that's coming.
I'm working on it. I'm finishing it up.
So it's not done yet. Okay. So if you're interested in reading some of Philip's writing, you can look for him in the bookstore. And he's got some things to tell us about. And I guarantee you we always have a good time when we do these shows. And
at the
end, we wish that we could keep going. So that's good. Let me give you our telephone numbers if you'd like to call in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. We are also going to have Tanya Leosakos from Pages for All Ages with us this morning. She's done the show here before many times, and she just called this morning and said she wasn't feeling well. So our best wishes go to her. Get better.
Yeah,
we'll see you again sometime soon. And we will carry on, Philip and I. Well, I'm glad glad to have you here again.
I'd love it to be here.
So you brought a number of things. I see that probably about a dozen or so titles.
I've got lots of stuff to talk about.
Well, pick something and we'll start.
Well, the first thing I think I want to do is do something I've never done before, and that is to talk about when it's time to put away the book that you can't stand.
Aha. I've had this experience of buying something and, and thinking that it was promising and, and starting it and getting into it and thinking, well, for somehow I'm just not clicking with it. So I stop. And maybe later I come back and I give it another shot. And actually, I know that there have been times that I've, after a couple of attempts, for some reason, it finally clicks with me and the book takes off and I'm great with it. Now, that's a different situation than if you... You know, somehow you just think, you know, I don't like, for whatever reason, I don't like this. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Should you feel duty-bound to just, just hammer on through the book?
I say throw the thing away. But that's not always true. And I guess I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I remember reading Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. And the first 100 pages, I must say, resisted me, or I resisted it. I didn't particularly care for the book. But it had won a Booker Prize, a prize that I have an enormous amount of respect for. So I plowed on thinking, maybe it's me. And it was me because it was a wonderful novel. I ended up loving this novel. But sometimes it's not the case. Now, in this case, this book, which I'm not going to name the author or the title of this book because I don't think that's really fair. I much prefer, you know, telling people to go out and read books rather than avoid something. Mm-hmm. But this book was recommended to me by the manager... One of the managers of Prairie Lights Bookstore, a fellow who is very, very well-read, and he'd recommended numbers of books to me before. Whenever I'd go to the give a reading when one of my books would come out, my basic excitement about going to Prairie Lights would be that this fellow would recommend 10 books that I should read, and I would always love them. And so this was one of those books, and I somehow never got around to it. I was recommended years and years ago, and it has so many wonderful blurbs and review quotes that they have to fit them on the front page of the paperback edition, which is something I've never seen before. And so I finally got around to it about 6 months ago, and I'm about 60 pages in, and I just feel I just don't like this book. Now, I think I probably would have gone on, but there was something about it that I realized really annoyed me, and that is everybody speaks in exclamation points. And so I started to page ahead, and I began to realize that there wasn't a two-page spread that didn't have an exclamation point somewhere. So I was looking forward to sort of, you know, fingers going down a chalkboard for 250 future pages. And in fact, there are a couple spreads two-page spreads where you won't find an exclamation point. And David, I'm going to give this book to you now. I defy you to find them. We can have a little parlor game here. Periodically over the hour, I want you to open the book any place and see if you can find two pages that doesn't have
an exclamation. Okay.
Okay, how are you doing there?
So far, not so good.
And it's not just one exclamation point. Frequently, you'll find five or six exclamation points on the page.
John, Marcia.
Oh, Marcia, my God. You hit the mother load, yeah.
I think I remember that being something by Stan Freeberg, wasn't it? Okay.
So, and that really, this book depressed. So I put this book away. And the only reason why, in fact, I didn't give it away or not even just get rid of it is because I thought I would bring it in and challenge you. I'm going to challenge you again over the course of the hour, okay?
Okay.
And this also made me feel that maybe I'm reading too much contemporary fiction, you know. So what should I be doing here? And I realized that there was a book that I'd been wanting to read for a while that I had, and it was a new translation of Stendhal's masterpiece, The Charterhouse of Parma, new translation by Richard Howard. And so I figured, well, maybe I should go back to the 19th century and get the 20th century out of my system. And what a good idea that was, because this is a magnificent translation of Stendhal's classic. I had read a previous translation, an earlier translation of this book many years ago, actually when I was living in Africa 20 years ago. And I'd always been a big fan of The Red and the Black by Stendhal. And I must say that I was disappointed by The Charterhouse of Parma. I always thought, well, maybe it's not up to its reputation. And again, here is where, you know, sometimes you're not served either by reviews or, in this case, by a translation that doesn't fit the spirit of the book. And Richard Howard's does. This is a magnificent book. It's set in the days leading up to Waterloo and the many years after Waterloo, during which time the sort of the conservative elements of European society are cracking down on the people who are still trying to live through some remnant of the spirit of the French Revolution and equality and so forth. And so it's a time of great political repression. And one of the main characters that we have here is a young man named Fabrizio, who is the illegitimate son of a French captain who came by earlier in the history of the French Wars. And he is a noble person, and yet no one really knows that he's not his father's real son. And he is filled with enthusiasm for Napoleon, and he actually manages, this young Italian count, to go to Waterloo. And he has a very hysterical time at Waterloo because he doesn't know what he's doing. He's a young man, and he's Italian. The Italians are fighting against Napoleon, and so if anybody figures out through his very bad French that he's Italian, he's going to get shot. And then it goes on from there. And the thing about this is there's wonderful political intrigue. There's swashbuckling events with sword fights and, you know, daring escapes and so forth. And yet, at the same time, this is a deeply serious book about politics and the corruption of politics and the conflicting impulses that people have and the way they can switch their principles in order to survive. It's an extraordinary book. And Fabrizio and the Countess Sanseverina and Count Mosca, just to name a few, are magnificent creations, absolutely magnificent fictional creations. And what I'd like to read here is just a little bit of Waterloo, where poor Fabrizio, who in fact, in order to get on the good side of the people who he's riding among in this battle at Waterloo, he has bought wine for everybody, and he's gotten drunk, and he doesn't know really what's going on around him. Fabrizio realized he was 20 paces to the right, out in front of the generals. He's managed, by the way, to get himself right next to the generals, some of the French generals, and they don't even know who he is, and precisely at the spot on which they were focusing their spyglasses. Returning to line up with the other hussars who had remained a few paces behind, he saw the fattest of these generals speaking to his neighbor with an authoritative, almost scolding expression. He was swearing. Fabrizio could not contain his curiosity, and in spite of the advice not to speak, which his friend the jailer's wife had given him, he worked out a very correct little French sentence and said to the man next to him, "Who is that general chewing out the one next to him?" "Damn, that's the marshal." "Which marshal?" "Marshal Ney, you idiot. Damn, where you been fighting till now?" Fabrizio, though extremely sensitive, had no thought of taking offense. He stared, lost in childish admiration of this famous prince of the Moscova, bravest of the brave. Suddenly, everyone galloped off. A few moments later, Fabrizio saw 20 paces ahead a plowed field that seemed to be strange in motion. The furrows were filled with water, and the wet ground that formed their crests were exploding into tiny black fragments flung 3 or 4 feet into the air. Fabrizio noticed this odd effect as he passed. Then his mind turned to daydreams of the marshal's glory. He heard a sharp cry beside him. Two hussars had fallen, riddled by bullets, and when he turned to look at them, they were already 20 paces behind the escort. What seemed horrible to him was a blood-covered horse struggling in the furrows and trying to follow the others. Blood was flowing into the mire. "Aha! Now we're under fire at last. I've seen action," he kept telling himself with a certain satisfaction. "Now I'm a true soldier." At this moment, the escort began galloping at breakneck speed, and our hero realized that these were bullets tearing up the earth. Though he tried to see where they were coming from, there was nothing but white smoke from the battery a great ways off. And amid the continuous roaring of cannon fire, he seemed to hear explosions much closer to him. He could make nothing of it.
Hmm. Tell me again, or tell us again now.
The Charterhouse of Parma by Stendhal.
Stendhal. And when was this written?
This was written in the 1830s.
So that was
in
not
six
very
weeks.
Long after this. Waterloo was in
14? I think 1814.
Something
first,
like that. Yeah. So this wasn't very...
No.
It would have been still sort of a recent
very
memory.
Very fresh in the minds of the people who had lived through it. And another remarkable thing about this book is that Stendhal wrote it. It's 500 pages long in 6 weeks, which you marvel at. The more you read and you realize the complexity of the book, the extraordinary psychological insight, and just the verve of it. It just reads so quickly. It's so delightful. 6 weeks, my God.
And this, is there a particular translation of this that you're,
yes,
you like?
This is Richard Howard's. It's the latest translation. It's the Modern Library Classics edition. It's now in paperback. And Howard catches this sort of quicksilver quality of the wit of Stendhal, as well as something of the speed of the sentences. And I think that, you know, the fact that he wrote this in 6 weeks really reflects itself in the way the sentences unfurl on the page. It really is a kind of a breakneck quality to it all. Mm. It's a wonderful book.
All right. Our guest this morning here on Focus 580 is Philip Graham. He's a writer. He teaches writing at University of Illinois and occasionally is here on the show. We talk about new books, and the way these programs work is he just brings a big armload of things that he's been reading to share with you. And for people who are listening, you can do the same. If there's something that you have read lately that you thought was particularly good, you'd like to recommend, that's great. 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana folks. For anyone else, if it would be long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455. Want to go on? Else?
Yes. Let's see. Okay. Now, this is the book that brought me back to realizing that, 20th century literature isn't so bad. And this is a book. Now, I have to say something, too. This is a book that's published by the New York Review of Books Press. And the last time I reviewed on the air a book of that press, it was... a book by the Italian novelist who had written a detective novel set in Sicily. I think you might remember that, who mm-hmm. I kept saying his name was Leonardo Sciascia. Well, I found out from a friend who has actually read The Gentleman in the Italian that, in fact, his name is Sciascia. It's pronounced Sciascia, Leonardo Sciascia. So for anybody out there who's saying Sciascia, you should be saying Sciascia. Just remember that. And also, it's a wonderful, wonderful book, To Each His Own by Leonardo Sciascia. Yes.
Very good.
I remember in the 60s, I would buy record albums that were put out by the Elektra label because they put out wonderful, wonderful music, the great bands like The Doors and so forth. And I figured if they were signed by Elektra, they must be good. So even, you know, without hearing a single note, I would pluck down some dough and give it a chance, you know. And now I'm beginning to feel that way about the New York Review of Books Press, because every book I've read by them so far, the books that they've reprinted, are just extraordinary. And this is one of them. This is a wonderful novel. It's by J.L. Carr, and it's called A Month in the Country. Now, this is a book that was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, I think in the 80s. And it's a very short novel. It's 135 pages long. But a very beautiful and very serious novel. You know, length means nothing in terms of quality. And I also discovered from talking with Harriet Williamson here at WILL that there's a movie called A Month in the Country that is based on this novel that I have never seen, but now I want to go out and get. And she said it's one of her favorite films. And all I can say is this is one of my favorite novels. And it's set in the aftermath of World War I, and it's a young man who has developed a terrible facial twitch and a stutter because of the things that he encountered in the trenches in France during World War I. And he is also an art conservator. And this is his first job after the war. He's gone up into the northern country of England to basically wash off the whitewash off a religious painting in an old country church that he has been commissioned by some people in the village to find out what's under this. The people suspect there's a real beautiful work of art there. And so that's what he's doing. And in fact, what he discovers over the course of the months is that he's discovered a masterpiece, that this is really quite an extraordinary work of art. Mm-hmm. And he also realizes, and it's one of the wonderful things about this book is how carefully the knowledge of art and art conservation is depicted in this book, because you get the techniques of how you just wash off without destroying what's underneath and so forth. And he's realizing that this particular particular work of art, this mural of the apocalypse, it's a mural of the apocalypse, the Christian apocalypse, must have been whitewashed no more than 30 or 40 years after it was done, and he can't figure out why. And at the same time, it's about his entering into this small town life and slowly becoming healed from the wounds that he gathered to himself during the war. And it's very quiet and understated and yet beautifully written. And there's a moment that I'd like to read here, and it's from that moment when he's really taking a good look at what work he's uncovered so far. So each day I released a few more inches of a seething cascade of bones, joints, and worm-riddled vitals frothing over the fiery wire. Again, this is an apocalypse scene, and this is the point right now where he's looking at everybody being cast down to hell. A few wretches were still intact. To these he hadn't given a great deal of attention. He is, in fact, the artist who he's really beginning to understand. He's beginning to understand the personality of this artist from 500 years ago by looking at the work that he's done. A few wretches were still intact. To these he hadn't given a great deal of attention. They were no more than fire fodder, all but one. And he, I could have sworn, was a portrait. A crescent-shaped scar on his brow made this almost certain. His bright hair streamed like a torch as, like a second Simon Magus, he plunged headlong down the wall. Two demons with delicately furred legs clutched him, one snapping his right wrist, whilst his mate split him with shears. It was the most extraordinary detail of medieval painting that I had ever seen, anticipating the Bruegels by 100 years. What, in this single detail, had pushed the artist this immense stride beyond his time? So there I was on that memorable day, knowing that I had a masterpiece on my hands, but scarcely prepared to admit it, like a greedy child hoards the best chocolates in the box. Each day, I used to avoid taking in the whole by giving exaggerated attention to the particular. Then, in the early evening, when the westering sun shone in past my baluster to briefly light the wall, I would step back, still purposefully not letting my eyes focus on it. Then I looked. It was breathtaking. Anyway, it took my breath. A tremendous waterfall of color, the blues of the apex falling, then seething into a turbulence of red, like all truly great works of art, hammering you with its whole before beguiling you with its parts. Mm.
That's
A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr.
And is that, when was that written?
This was written in the 80s. Actually, J.L. Carr is a very interesting person. There's a bit of information on him in the introduction. And he apparently was a full-time teacher at a private school in England until he was 57 and then quit to become a full-time writer and made a living simply by his writing. And two of his books were nominated but did not win the Booker Prize. Mm.
And that's Britain's top literary prize.
Top prize. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, it's second only to the Nobel Prize in terms of just the quality of the work that consistently gets awarded over the years.
Is it bigger than the National Book Award? Than our National Book
Award?
Well,
I don't know. I mean, that's a great prize too. It's always the Pulitzer and so forth. The Booker Prize, I think, is able to cast a wider net because it's not only a prize for the best book published in England, but anybody's eligible who was once a Commonwealth country. So you get people like Salman Rushdie who could win it, or Ben Okri from Nigeria who could win it. I mean, you have people who, you know, were from the Commonwealth countries of the vast empire of England. So practically everybody in the world, you know, you think of the empire of England in the 19th century into the 20th. So there's a great, great, great amount of wonderful literature that's available for nomination for this prize.
We have a caller here who's been waiting patiently.
Oh, okay.
Let's talk with them in Bloomington on line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
It sounds very interesting what the professor has been talking about, but I'm a little more interested in later books. Do you know if Elizabeth George has written any more books in that series of hers? The last one that I read was In Pursuit of the Proper Sinner. Do you know if she's written any since that?
I have to confess, I don't know who Elizabeth George is.
Yeah,
perhaps
you don't
maybe,
know her at all.
Why don't you tell us? Because if I don't, maybe other people out there don't.
Well, I think David knows.
Yeah. Is she the one who she writes historical novels set in the Elizabethan period?
No,
I'm thinking. I'm thinking of somebody else. Well, here I see.
That's okay.
Here's a book that's just come out, or I guess it's going to come out, titled "A Traitor to Memory." By Elizabeth George. I'm looking here on the Amazon site, and it will be published in June of this year, and they say at Amazon you can order it now.
Uh-huh.
You can also order it from a local bookstore.
Oh yes, that's true. Yeah, no, we definitely believe in
the bookstore. Is there anything in that article? On the website that you're speaking of, David, that indicates that that is the next book in her series after In Pursuit of the Proper Sinner?
No, because it doesn't, as far as I can see here, there's no review. It doesn't say anything about the book other than the author, the title, and
I assume it's in that same, serial writing that she's been doing about the Earl of Asherton and his assistant Barbara Havers from the CID in London. I assume it's the same.
It looks like here In Pursuit of the Proper Sinner is the most recent that's in print. This is it says it's in paper, was published in December of last year. So I would assume, and then here's also a book titled Playing for the Ashes. A Woman After God's Own Heart.
That's quite some time.
Deception on His Mind, Payment in Blood, The Witch of Blackbird Pond. Oh, that's somebody else. it looks like that's probably the one that's going to be coming out in June and should be the most recent.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Well, other folks, if you have particularly you have books that you'd like to recommend, you can give us a call because obviously Philip doesn't know everything.
No, by far from it. Elizabeth George. I don't know who Elizabeth
George
is.
He's always interested in having suggestions. So if there's a book that you've read lately you thought was particularly good, tell us about it. And otherwise, we'll just continue. We do these books occasionally to just suggest titles and authors to you that you might not be familiar with. And Philip does an awful lot of reading and wide, and he likes a lot of different sorts of things. And I have benefited by some of his recommendations.
Thank you. I have another one, but first,
this book that
Find
we will
two pages
not name.
That
okay, here's 2 pages, no exclamation points. I think I have one page.
Two pages.
Okay.
It's got to be 2 pages.
Okay,
spread.
Not be 2 pages spread.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, here, 148, 149,
okay, all right.
I think.
There you go.
Just,
oh, come on, you're kidding.
See if did I miss it?
No, you win.
Well, it is my show.
Yeah, that's true. That's probably what's going on here. There are a lot of question marks, but that doesn't count.
Well, that's you did say exclamation points.
No, I'm not taking anything back. It's okay,
right.
You win. Okay, now this is a book, a very short little book by a philosopher named Ted Cohen. Called Jokes, Philosophical Thoughts on Joking Matters. And this is a philosopher at the University, professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago, who's written a book about why jokes are or are not funny and why they do the things that they do. And he's not only talks about the jokes, but he gives a couple jokes. I've got a couple jokes in this philosophical disquisition. So this will be interesting to hear some philosophy.
What kind of jokes
and
philosophers
jokes.
Tell?
Well, there are some jokes in this book that I cannot read over the air. But anyway, it is a very widespread conviction shared by me that some jokes on some occasions, and maybe some jokes on all occasions, are, as we say, in bad taste and should be thought of as morally objectionable. But it is very, very difficult to say just what this moral defect is. First is the problem of finding a basis for any moral judgment passed upon fiction, and then there is the problem of establishing the impropriety of laughing at something, especially when the something is fictional. Fiction itself might be objectionable as such, for instance, when one puts it forth in hopes of inducing a belief in something false, but surely this is not characteristic of jokes. I say this to you. A man was told by his doctor that to improve his health, he should take up jogging, and he should run 2 miles every day. After a couple of weeks, the man was to call the doctor to tell him how he was feeling. 2 weeks later, the man called, and the doctor asked, "So, how are you doing?" "I feel pretty good," said the man, "but I'm 28 miles from home." Uh-huh. Now, you laughed at that. Would you object or be angry with me because I had told you a falsehood? Ridiculous. Of course, even if there were such a misguided jogger, you might still find that funny. Consider again this exquisite children's joke. What do Alexander the Great and Winnie the Pooh have in common? They have the same middle name. Would you object to this, that it is not true that the word "the" is not the middle name of either character, and furthermore, that there is no such creature as Winnie the Pooh? Ridiculous. It cannot be an objection solely that the joke contains falsehoods. In fact, in many cases, the entire joke is a falsehood. Actually, it is a fiction, and a fiction is not simply a falsehood, and a joke is not simply fiction.
Jokes by Ted Cohen.
Yes, philosophical thoughts.
Philosophical thoughts
on joking,
matters.
Matters.
We're here at 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL with Philip Graham. And again, I say if people are just content to listen, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I just want to make sure that everyone feels welcome if you would like to call in, if there is a book that you've read recently you would like to recommend.
Yes.
Or you have some other question about writing or publishing or something like
anything
that.
At all.
Anything at all to do with books. Yes. I know Philip would do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be long-distance call, use that number, and that's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, we can continue.
Okay. Now we're going into the Portuguese literature section of the show.
have you been, or are you still getting ready to go?
I'm still getting ready. My wife and I, Alma Gottlieb, we're taking actually Portuguese lessons from a tutor. So we're learning our stuff. But at the same time, I'm just reading all sorts of things. These are actually Brazilian novels written in Portuguese. And it's part of a very lovely series run by Oxford University Press called The Library of Latin America. And this is a series that is attempting to translate into English some of the very, very great novels, primarily of the 19th, but also 20th century, of Latin America, South America, including the Portuguese-speaking Brazil and the Spanish-speaking countries, that we don't know about. Hmm. In other words, you know, we know our literature in North America very, very well, but there's an equally wonderful literature in South America that simply doesn't get translated, and especially some of the classic works that every South American child would know in high school or college. And so this is making available to us a kind of reclaiming a kind of literature that we didn't even know needed to be reclaimed. And it's a wonderful series, and the two books that I have read so far in it, because I am deeply prejudiced towards the Portuguese side of things, these are books from Brazil. The first one that I'd like to talk about is Machado de Assis, who is considered by very, very many people. He's perhaps one of the most well-known South American writers of the 19th century, a world-class writer. And this is one of his better-known novels, The Posthumous Memoirs of Brás Cubas. And it's a novel that is written by a ghost who's writing his life history. And this is the epigraph to the ghost's book. "To the worm who gnawed the cold flesh of my corpse, I dedicate these posthumous memoirs as a nostalgic remembrance.
Very nice.
Which sort of sets the tone for the rest of this novel, which has actually more chapters than it has pages, since sometimes there are two chapters to a page. And they're very, very short but chronological remembrances of this man's life, a man who basically squandered his life. He was well off. He wasted it on affairs and small-time political things, and just he basically did nothing with his life. And now that he has eternity to look at the nothing that he did with it, he basically is looking at the various vanities and personal problems that he had that enabled him to squander his life. And he's looking at it not with bitterness, but a kind of cosmic humor and how foolish he could have been to live the life the way he did. And so it's actually a very, very dark but very, very funny book. Very, very funny book. And then there's another book here in the same series. This is by Aloysio Azevedo. And it's called The Slum. And it's a book that basically is talking about the building of a slum in Rio de Janeiro. And it gives you basically a sense of the favelas, what are called the favelas now in Brazil, the terrible, terrible slums that we read about periodically. This is the origins of the favelas. This is how they came about. And this is a book that really has no central character. There are important characters in the book, but there's so many characters in this book, and they go across so many levels of society and race, class, you name it. It's a book that really is about the society as well as it is about individuals. And it's a beautiful and terrifying book about how slums can be built and the people who live in them and how they can be destroyed and the ways in which class and race can destroy lives. It's really quite extraordinary novel. And again, I'd never heard of it until this press made it available to English. So, again, if you're looking for, you know, wonderful literature that you simply have never heard of but has not been available to you, this is a very good series to check out, and they have their own website. This is the Library of Latin America, available through Oxford University Press.
Mm-hmm. All right. You may have mentioned this, but I guess I'm concerned. I'm curious about what it is that so grabbed you about Portugal.
If I could answer that, I don't know. It's not just Portugal. It's also Brazil. It's also Cabo Verde. It's also the Azores and Madeira and Angola and Mozambique. I mean, any part of the Portuguese cultural range just seems to get to me. It's just one of those mysterious things. Now, I do know that there's something, there's a port wine in the Douro region of Portugal that is called Graham Port. And I know that there were a number of English and Scottish people who went down to Portugal centuries ago, and they were instrumental in starting the port wine industry in Portugal. So sometimes I wonder if there's a little genetic thread somewhere back in the centuries, some little ancestor who lived in Portugal, and here I am benefiting from that, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It is such a beautiful language. It's got to be one of the most musical languages ever.
Yeah, yeah. Cuts French, as far as I'm concerned. So I don't mean to insult anybody out there, but I just think it cuts French. Yeah, it's a beautiful language. Mm-hmm. And both versions, the Portuguese or the Brazilian version, they're very different. But they're both, I think, equally beautiful.
Right. Well, we have about 15 minutes left in the program, and I'm just content to have Philip continue.
And I have six books here, so we're working away.
But I just want to make sure people who are listening, if you want to call in,
Don't be shy.
If you have a book to recommend or a question or whatever you'd like to talk to Philip, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Okay.
All right. Now, continuing the Portuguese section of this, I have two more books. This is Portuguese-American literature, which I didn't really know existed. And what happened is I'm beginning to get a reputation for somebody who reads this kind of stuff. So I was notified by people in the department that there was a student who was looking for somebody. She herself is Portuguese-American, was looking to do a readings course in Portuguese-American literature. So I, of course, got on the web and looked around and found there are a few writers out there, and I've been reading some books with this particular student, and oh, are they wonderful. This is a novel by Frank X. Gaspar, or Gaspar, G-A-S-P-A-R. It's called Leaving Pico, and Pico is one of the main islands of the Azores, which in fact is a series of islands in the Atlantic that are Portuguese. And this novel, though, is set in Provincetown on Cape Cod. And I think it might be a surprise for people who are in town, who have gone once or twice or perhaps a great number of times to Cape Cod, that Provincetown is 50% Portuguese-American. That is a Portuguese-American town that most tourists don't know because they don't go into the, you know, the local areas and really check out what the people who live there are doing. Mm-hmm. And so this is a wonderful novel by Frank Gaspar about the people that the tourists don't notice. It's set in the 1950s. And it's told to the point of view of Josie Carvalho, a boy who doesn't know who his father is. The mystery of his parenthood is a big problem in his family. His great-aunt Theophilia is a very religious woman who has religious visions periodically. She's always fighting with Josie's mother. Josie's father Josie's mother's father is a wonderful old man, but also kind of irresponsible fellow and a drunk and so forth. And he's really torn between these two parts of his family. And just the writing is very, very beautiful. And here's one part where Josie, who really is trying to sort of honor both sides of his family, he goes out and fishes with his grandfather, and there were wonderful, wonderful descriptive sections of getting caught in a storm or fishing and so forth. But he also has to pay attention to his great aunt Theophilia and her religious teachings. And so he's begun to know lots of things about all the saints, and not only the saints, but he knows how they died. And whenever the priest comes, whenever great-aunt Theophilia has a vision, the priest comes to talk to her about it and try to figure out what in fact she has seen. And this is what happens when he comes to the door. Father Santos comes to the door. Whenever he visited us, he would keep up a running quiz on the deaths of the holy martyrs, which he knew my aunt had taught me. So whenever I answered the door and let him in, he would greet me with something like, "Quick, Josie, St. Jeremy." And I would say, "Beheaded." "Aha." "And Juliana?" "Beheaded." "Just beheaded?" "Tortured and beheaded." "Exactly, nice boy, exactly. And is your Aunt Hetty in the parlor?" "Yes, please, come in." "Thank you." "And St. Victor, what about St. Victor?" "Basted in hot lead." "Wonderful, wonderful." And he would go in and sit with my great aunt.
Leaving Pico.
Oh, and I'm not done yet. I got another wonderful thing. This is also dealing with the saints and so forth. Because what Josie really wants, he wants a father. And so what he does is he starts to pray to his name saint for a father. And in fact, very soon after that, a man appears who is quite interested in his mother. But he's not quite sure, was it me or was it the saint? According to Sheikha Nunez and my great aunt, it was important to remember that the saints were once real people who had talked and breathed just like anyone else. This is why we kept images of them in plaster and plastic and stone and wood. It helped us to keep from confusing them with, say, angels, which we could never become, unless we died as an infant right after baptism while we were still in the most pure state of grace available. But this was something that was beyond our reach once we were old enough to even think about it. The images were only there to remind us of the saints, but the images didn't have any special properties. Unless there was a miracle, like when a wooden statue would weep real tears for whole crowds of people to see, but this usually only happened in one of the old countries. The statues and cards on Great Aunt Theophilia's bureau had no miraculous properties themselves. We had to pray beyond them. Once, my grandfather choked the image of Saint Anthony, patron of lost objects, when he couldn't find his good hand line. This was a wooden rack of heavy gauge line that he used for fishing in the deep channels for monster halibut. He had been about to miss a good tide and came in from the woodhouse cursing in Portuguese and thumping around the house in his hip boots. Finally, he stumped into Aunt Theophilia's room and grabbed that mild-faced statue around the neck and throttled it. "Give it up," he grunted, his thick knuckles turning gray with force, as though he might pop the head off the plaster body. He had his hand line back within minutes, which must have puzzled him, for I had slipped out and put it back into his gear basket, right where he had just looked for it. I had taken the line earlier that morning to show to Roger and Lou, and I had forgotten it on their upstairs kitchen table. It was just another one of those situations that clarified nothing. You could say a saint was behind it, acting through me, Or you could say otherwise. Cases like this didn't prove much. They just kept you thinking.
I like that very much.
It's a wonderful book. And the thing that's wonderful about this book is that in the middle of it, something happens that is deeply unpredictable and yet beautifully prepared for. So you're surprised, but you're not tricked in terms of what the relationships are in the family. And then the novel turns into something else again, which is the grandfather and Josie having these storytelling sessions in a hidden part of the house at night about their great ancestor Carvalho, who the grandfather claims discovered America a year before Columbus. And so they tell this tale of how he could have done it and how it could still remain a secret. It's a beautiful book, just a beautiful. I can't recommend. This is a book that I would finish reading it at night. I would kiss the cover. This is a book where you go, and you kiss the book, and you say, I'll be back tomorrow. It's just a wonderful book.
Well, okay, ladies and gentlemen. The title of the book is Leaving Pico by Frank Gaspar.
Yes.
All right. We have two callers here.
Okay.
Let's talk with them. Both in Champaign. First, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
I want to tell you about a book I got recently, Witness to America.
Uh-huh.
It's a large book, and it has original writings from different people over the different historic things that started from Revolutionary War clear up to now.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll have the real words of Patrick Henry when he made his speech, you know.
Oh, that sounds great.
And John Brown stand at Harper's Ferry. And Franklin D. Roosevelt's promise of the New Deal. And then it has Neil Armstrong's account of walking on the moon. And it is a fascinating book.
It sounds good.
It's a huge book. But I think anybody would be happy to get it and read it. It has 605 pages.
Wow. So it's like history through the voices of the people who made it.
Yes, Witness to History by Stephen Ambrose and Douglas Brinkley are the editors.
Okay.
Oh, I think my son would like that as well
Stephen,
as my son.
I suppose that's the Stephen Ambrose.
Oh, yeah.
The,
yes.
The one who had undaunted courage.
Mr.
And
Ambrose.
Other, yes, to you, yeah. Mr. Ambrose to you. And Douglas Brinkley. In fact, I think Celeste recently talked with him or was going to talk with him. He wrote a biography of... The woman who wouldn't give up her seat on a bus.
Yes. That's
Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks. Thank you. Rosa Parks. Yes.
Originally, this was edited in 1939, but now it's been brought up to date.
Okay.
And you can pick it up anytime and read, you know, just a section.
Great.
And, I suggest anybody ought to get it.
Terrific. And it's called Witness to History?
Witness to America.
Witness to America. Okay.
And inside it has an audio CD featuring action.
Oh, beautiful.
And dramatizations of the great moments in history.
Well, great. Well, good. Excellent suggestion.
It's a little expensive, but it's worth it.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's talk with another person here. This is Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Hi, yes. I hate to break your Portuguese theme.
Oh, I'm done. It's okay. Thanks.
I was wondering where you stand on the John Updike debate. I know that lots of people feel that he's kind of maybe shallow in his writings, a little directly masculine maybe. And I'm just a young boy, but I think that he's very important in modern writers, and I was just wondering how you feel.
Well, I have to say he's not my favorite writer. I think he has great, great gifts as a writer. But I don't think that he knows how to turn off the gift. And so very, very often you cannot tell one character from another. You can have a professor talking in the same sort of highfalutin way that someone working a soda jerk counter will do. I mean, I find so often that there's a kind of look ma, no hands quality to his prose. He has great, great gifts and abilities, and he wants everybody to know it. And after a while, I begin to feel oppressed when I read his book. So I have to admit, I've stopped reading John Updike. I haven't been interested in many years. But I know, again, so many people who love the work. And the great thing about a book is that you only read it for yourself. No one tells you that this is the book you have to read. And if you like it and someone doesn't, well, that's too bad for them, but it's very good for you. So I'd say it doesn't matter what someone else thinks about Updike. If you like his work, keep reading.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll squeeze one more. Line three in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. Isn't it wonderful to be able to talk to books, to other book lovers? I think it is second only to reading the book. Don't you agree?
Yeah.
And I am delighted that Philip likes A Month in the Country, because this is our March selection for the International Authors Book Group at Borders.
And I
would like to take the chance to invite any of you listeners to join us. Every month we pick a book by an international author, and they are not difficult books, you know. I mean, they're just, we pick them sometimes from one country, sometimes from another.
Yeah.
And I would like to maybe recommend Gail Tsukiyama. I don't know, have you read any?
No, I haven't. I don't know the name.
She is an American but has Chinese-Japanese parents. And she has written two books about their novels. One is The Women of Silk, or The House of Silk. The Women of Silk. Mm-hmm. And the other is The Language of Threads. And it is about silk making and how the girls were bought from their parents and they were put into these factories and their salaries were paid to the families.
Uh-huh.
They sort of lived together almost like in a sorority. And it's a very interesting setup and a very interesting, both of the books are very interesting, but my favorite one is called The Summerized Garden, and it's the most beautiful love story I have read in a long time. And even describing it would spoil it.
There are books like that.
Haiku poems.
Goodness.
It's very, very lovely. I really recommend it. It's a small book, but just exquisite. And then we have done other interesting things in our group. We read Places Left Unfinished at the Time of Creation, which is a family biography of a Mexican family in San Antonio, beautifully written, very interesting.
Oh, great.
And we read The Desert Flower, which is the life story of this girl that grew up in the desert, really truly in the desert, and ends up as the top fashion model in New York. And she's now a patroness of the United Nations against female mutilation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very interesting book also that we read. So as you can see, we always pick good stuff.
Sounds great.
And,
sounds great.
We would love to have, you know, any other book lovers that are listening to join us. And I would like to thank you for your book talk. It's always interesting. I always get good ideas.
Thank you. Thank you for recommendations. I've written down all of the Tsukiyama books you mentioned.
All right. You know, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We have somebody we can't take.
And I have these wonderful Wizard of Oz books to talk about. But
you'll just have to come back another day. In fact, I think we're planning in April, we're going to do a fun drive. Don't tell anybody. we'll have Philip and hopefully Tanya will be here. And we'll do 2 hours. So we'll have plenty of time. And in the meantime, go to the library, go to the bookstore, read. It's something we believe in on this show.
You got to do it.
We do a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Philip Graham.
Thanks.
He's professor of English at University of Illinois. Occasionally, he joins us and we do these shows about books.